The Science Basement!
Hello and welcome to the Science Basement podcast, a podcast for those who love all things science. I'm Rhiannon, your host for today, and joining me as co-host is Katya.
Hello.
And today it's time for the fifth and final episode of our High Life mini-series. As a quick recap, High Life is one of the major life science institutions in the Nordics and is based in Helsinki, Finland. So far in the mini-series, we have delved into the importance of life science research, the overlap between business and research, as well as mentoring and leadership in science. So please go check out the episodes if you haven't already.
And in today's episode, we'll be diving into the societal impact of research, arguably one of the key reasons we do research in the first place. To chat with us about their experience with science and society, we are joined by Marjo Saastamoinen, a High Life Associate Professor within the Faculty of the Biological and Environmental Sciences at the University of Helsinki, and Kirsi Mikkonen, who is a professor in the Department of Food and Nutrition in High Life at the University of Helsinki. Welcome both. How are you today?
Thank you. It's very nice to be here.
Thank you. Doing very well today. Thanks. Thanks for inviting.
Very glad to hear.
So, should we jump straight in? Our first question today is, what does the societal impact of science and research mean to the both of you in your research lives and careers?
I can answer this maybe first. So in my research, I find that the societal impact is a lot related to impact that we do on industries. My field of science is it's food sciences, and we work with ensuring that the food chain brings healthy, sustainable, tasty, good food for consumers. And that is what we do with research. Sometimes we get innovations in the research that can be brought to commercial applications. That is one very direct way of impacting the society. Of course, there is more impact coming from research results, what is related to food legislation, food policies, nutritional recommendations, etc. There's many ways of impacting.
Quite a lot of
and
a short
list. I might even add to that one important aspect is to communicate to general public and mitigate towards misinformation, which is largely an issue with food.
Yeah. Okay. Lots we can get into that. And what about you, Mario?
So my research focuses on understanding how biodiversity has changed. So I feel that the kind of societal impact I have is to get the general public more aware of what biodiversity is, how biodiversity is changing, declining, and then what we could sort of do about it. And then also raise awareness for different sectors, so decision makers and so forth, about how should we measure biodiversity and what can we do to preserve it.
That sounds fantastic and really great to have you both here today to lead us through the topic of societal impacts of science on society. Could you more concretely give some examples of what sort of outreach you do, Mario?
So, for example, to reach general public, we have created video series of sort of the importance, how biodiversity is measured, why it's important to understand it, and what's happening to it, to school children over the pandemic time. So we did a video series of 10 episodes, which also included some questions and sort of tasks that children could carry out with their teachers in schools to understand biodiversity better. Then a bit more broader scale, we've organized events where we've invited researchers across different sectors, so not just from universities, but also research institutes, as well as people from ministries or more sort of decision makers to come and discuss about the relevance of biodiversity, how is it assessed, and again, what we could do better, how could we improve things in the future. And then also to hear how we would provide information that is actually needed for better decisions to be made.
I think it's very important, that last thing you mentioned. Well, firstly, it sounds like you're doing a lot of great outreach or kind of societal links to your research, which is really, really nice to hear. And also for my field of kind of molecular biology, it's quite cool to hear how different kind of research topics such as biodiversity, which obviously to me is very important, how it goes about making these policy changes. Because I think in my field, it's not so much really done with the healthcare side of things. I think it's much more of a gap. Like you might communicate your research, but it's not so much people, in my experience anyway, people don't really try and influence the policies as much. It's kind of more, which I think is a shame, because like you say, with yours, when you listen to what people want from your research in this kind of two-directional manner, then you can also learn what they think or what they might know already or might not understand so well. And you can kind of learn to communicate your research better, also learn what maybe is needed. So,
yeah, I guess this is especially now with biodiversity loss, because it's so timely topic.
Yeah.
And it's we are becoming more and more aware of the crisis that we are facing and the relevance of it across everything that we do.
Like,
we need to have biodiversity to actually live in this planet.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think it's also becoming sort of everyone wants to understand it better and know what they can do about it to prevent further loss. So it's a sort of a topical theme to be doing research at the moment.
Yeah. And Kersi, you mentioned that your research in kind of the food science field, you have a lot of links to innovation. Can you give a bit more details or maybe examples of how your research is linked to innovation directly? And
yeah, I will be happy to give some concrete examples of the innovations, but also happy to find a link between Marios and myself, the work, because the biodiversity challenge is a huge one. And one thing that we face in the food sciences is the need of agricultural land to produce food for everyone. And that is a big threat to biodiversity because of the growing population, and we need increasing amount of land, and the weather conditions and environmental changes actually affect a lot the food production, and it's very directly linked with biodiversity. And the innovations that I've been working with are technological solutions to different sustainability issues.
Okay.
And for example, I can mention innovations related to preventing food waste. That is a big issue. We put a lot of resources in producing food, and then a big part of that is currently lost during either the production chain or then in the end user at the consumer's home. So we are developing technical solutions to prevent food waste. Other research topics are related to using plant biomass in a more efficient way, actually utilizing and valorizing some unconventional biomasses actually derived from wood and bringing that into the food chain using certain wood components as food ingredients. That is one. Those are some of the examples. We are working with fresh cut vegetables, and they are a big challenge. They are like product category which consumption is increasing. And consumers like those convenient products, but they have issues with the shelf life. So how we can increase that, and bringing more healthy, more sustainable products accessible to consumers. That's where most of the innovations are related to.
It's also great to hear how both of your research links very directly to the future of our planet and, you know, impacting society through ensuring a healthier planet, as well as then also doing outreach, you know, in that sense of informing people and asking the policymakers what's needed and what research. And then on the business side, also very concretely seeing, you know, and doing also bringing these things into the future and the technologies. So,
yeah, I think it highlights, especially with both of your fields being so topical, is the word. If you just do the research and you don't try and, you know, have the think about the impact on society or how you can convey this, then it's not that it's pointless, but it's almost as important as doing the research itself, because if people don't understand or have misinformation, or you're not listening to them, and you're, you know, it's both ways, then it's almost up to them to try and find things out, which can be quite tricky if you're not from a science background. So yeah, I also wanted to ask about the innovation quickly on the things you mentioned about the products or things you're developing. How does it actually work with the industry? Like, is it you have the idea and then you contact the industries, or is it kind of you think of an area that is needed a product from your research, or which comes first, the research or the industry part?
There's many opportunities. The ones I've been working with are ideas stemming from basic research at the university. I've been happy working with topics and projects that have a long-term history in the basic research and have been lucky to see the phase where it transforms into innovations and potentially ideas that can be commercialized. Mm-hmm. We do collaborate, we do industrial collaboration where there can be contract research. Sometimes the university has policies how to share IP of such collaborative mm-hmm. works. And sometimes companies come to us with their ideas and would like us to do experiments and support the findings. So it goes both ways.
Yeah. Okay.
And even I'm really happy to let you know that from my research group, another principal investigator has just established their own startup company based on an idea that was developed in a basic research project. So that is also a possibility not to work with established industries, but actually make a spin-out company from the university.
And is this kind of, is it like, did you have to learn as you were researching how to make such a kind of transition to industry, like how to make these connections, and did you learn that kind of more business side of the research yourself, or was it kind of natural, kind of how did it come to work like that? Because I think in a lot of scientific fields, at least as I say with mine and molecular biology, it's more, much more public money. My lab actually has quite a lot of links to industry, so I have a bit of, you know, knowledge from there. But often I think it's kind of people have this public funding and then they just do the research, and someone might at some point think that this is needed, some business idea or some product they can develop. So how did it kind of work in your career that you made?
There are different opportunities for that. So I do a lot of basic research too, and find that the key importance of that. But there are also funding opportunities offered for research commercialization and proof of concept projects that take those ideas developed in basic research, take them steps further towards commercialization. There was one very specific call by previous Academy of Finland, now Research Council of Finland. Mm-hmm. Earlier years, it was a so-called key project. It was, I believe, just a one-time effort that they had this kind of project that were supporting research done by earlier funded fundamental projects. Mm-hmm. There are other types of funding for those purposes, like Business Finland projects, mm-hmm. That where you can apply funding for that kind of work, which is closer to industries. And then there is also a tradition in food sciences to collaborate with industries.
Yeah, because I was going to say, I think it, from what you're saying, it sounds much more this tradition than in molecular biology, at least anyway. Okay.
And what about you, Mario? How did you go from just the research side into also this outreach and also policymaking to some extent side of conservation research? Was it a very natural thing that you were doing before, or did the research come first?
So I think for me, it started with this consortium that we initiated in 2018. So we joined forces together with four other PIs at the University of Helsinki, Research Center for Ecological Change, where we started collating these long-term monitoring data of Finnish taxa together. And then with that data to try to understand how has Finnish nature changed over time, potentially due to climate change or other anthropogenic pressures. And with kind of that idea, we then actively decided that we want to try to reach out also audience beyond just the academics. And then we kind of planned and initiated ideas of doing these videos or organizing events, inviting people to hear more about our work and kind of initiate this discussion with different sectors.
And because it's such a current and important topic, how was it received by kind of policy makers? Was it a productive conversation, or was it a bit of you had to think about how you phrase things, or how did you find this kind of two-way conversation?
So I think it's still a learning curve. Mm-hmm. Of course, I think with the maturity of policy and decision makers, it is a very positive, and we're kind of all on the same side. But I think it is more when we think of then the general public or maybe some other sectors where the discussion can get a bit more heated. Mm-hmm. Because, of course, we are talking about industries needing to provide things, and then, you know, conservation on the other side saying that we should slow down and not utilize our natural resources as much as we are now. So I think there it is just important to listen to each other, be open to these discussions, and then also be kind of clear with the communication. What is the message that we want to say, but then also maybe not be too negative about everything, but also try to provide solutions or natural ways of kind of keep the communication going. But I think it's, the communication is definitely a key to get the message across and keep the discussion going.
It's also really nice that actually you mentioned this innovation side of things when Kirsi, your topic is, you know, leaping next to this as well with the food waste, you know, prevention initiatives and things. So clearly it is working, you know, there is the two-way discussion is being had, and it's...
And I think in this sense, the innovations related to biodiversity or getting in contact with businesses and so forth, we are still kind of emerging field on that sense. But there's definitely interest from businesses and companies to understand better on how can they measure the impact they have or their actions are having on biodiversity, and how could they potentially compensate for it. So I think there's also sort of great need for ecologists to spread out to different sectors to help with the needs that is there. And I think this is also the important societal impact of university overall, is that we are actually educating experts on these fields who then can spread out to different sectors to have an impact.
It was quite interesting what you said about how to communicate, because different people come and listen to information from different perspective. And what we face is also that in food science, when you communicate about food and more sustainable food choices, that is sometimes a delicate issue that is good to take in mind when talking to consumers, for example. One area of innovations that I'm also working with is alternative proteins, sources of proteins to replace animal-based proteins. And that is a topic that is generally in science acknowledged that it's relevant, that we need alternative like plant-based sources for our nutrients. But when a consumer makes their food choice, when they go to supermarket, they often base their selections on their personal need at the moment. And that is based on different aspects that they value in the food. But that is something we really want to communicate and how to address people. For some people, it's more easy to try and test new things and they find it motivating. But for some, it's more difficult to say, let's, for example, change eating habits that they have had for all their life before.
Yeah, I think that's why you tend to see younger people maybe being a bit more open to trying all sorts of new food, actually, not even just like alternative proteins, you know, as I'm vegetarian and also vegetarian, so I guess we know a lot about them, but even just thinking about it more. So like, for example, I remember when I was first vegetarian, my parents were quite big meat eaters, even though my mum actually does not like meat. I hope she doesn't listen to this, because she'll... I do. But anyway, she often would say, oh, I don't like this meat in this, if you go to a restaurant, you know. But then just because of what she's used to, she would often still order the meat, because the vegetarian option is, oh no, I don't want that. And then my brother also turned vegetarian, and since then, both of my parents actually have got more realised that, yeah, it doesn't necessarily mean doesn't taste nice just because it's not what you're used to.
Yeah, and that's something very important in food science field, and not my personal research areas, but other people working with food and nutrition is also impacting through recommendations.
Mm-hmm.
And now a very topical issue is the new Nordic food recommendations of the diet as a whole. And in that, in those new recommendations that were just recently published, they take into account also sustainability issues and not only the diet quality and nutrition perspective. So that is one important way of trying to communicate to people about those things.
Yeah, I think this kind of importance of how do we communicate is extremely important. We just had a new paper that came out about whether protected areas are actually preventing or slowing down biodiversity decline.
Mm-hmm.
And the main result we found that maybe at the moment the protected areas aren't doing as good of a job as we would hope. And so we wanted to be extremely careful when making the press release that we don't want to say that protected areas is not a solution, but kind of highlight that at the moment they don't maybe do as well as they should, and how we need to improve the current network of protected areas and also make sure that we take care of the environment outside protected areas to halt kind of the biodiversity loss. So just being very careful of what is the key message that we want to say so that people wouldn't misunderstand some of the maybe complex analyses and results that we are obtaining.
Just to add to what you've said, but kind of going back to the food side of it, I think it's the same thing like with this vegetarian thing, or maybe people's misconceptions or what they're used to. I think what I was trying to say as well is it's not like you have to become vegetarian. It's just learning maybe you can eat less or something, or just change the way that you are consuming things, or in this case, like improve something in a way that's still benefiting it, but it doesn't mean that what you're doing is bad. In a way, it's kind of an important thing to...
And also, like, thinking of biodiversity and food production, there are also, of course, things that aren't easy to solve. If we think of being vegetarian, for sure, is important. But then at the same time, I work with butterflies, for example. And in Finland, for butterflies to exist, we actually need grazing, because these maintain habitats and meadows that are needed for butterflies.
Yeah.
So, you know, we shouldn't have so much meat production or... such, but something is good also for biodiversity.
Yeah, it's also one way of using grass as a source of like going to the food chain and ending up as protein is meat production actually, or dairy production. So it's not that straightforward.
I remember just reminded me of something that I also listened to once that I never thought about, which is quite related to food production, and you can correct me if I'm remembering it wrong, but it was also linked to this grazing kind of thing and how like actually for the soil quality you need this, you can't just have crops because then the soil quality does decrease. I think this is based in the UK where I'm from. And often they'd rotate the fields and have certain, maybe some grains or something for a bit. And then they put the animals there to maybe improve the soil quality. And this was something that I never actually had thought about before, because I was always thinking, oh, it's better to decrease the amount of animals we have for the societal impact. But actually they're important, and it does reinstate the fact that I guess everything is important, but in moderated amounts.
Yeah, that's a very important point, and that highlights the need for a proper and discussion about matters and delivering like studied information to people. I might bring up one example again from food sciences, is that some researchers talk about processed food or even ultra-processed food. Meaning with that some foods which contain like refined flour, for example, high in starch, high in sugar, high in fat, high in salt, for example, and that's often considered as unhealthy. But what we would like to remind people with it's that actually it's not the processing itself that makes food unhealthy. It's more about the choices for the ingredients. And actually food processing itself, I would like to take that as a neutral term. We need processing in order to make food more stable and avoid the food loss and waste that I mentioned before. And we can have processed food that is completely fulfilling the criteria for healthy nutrition. So that is something we would like to communicate more, is that there is no need to avoid processing in that sense. But more be careful of the selection of the ingredients and how the food is composed.
Both of you actually already mentioned quite a few of the challenges and benefits with working in this like outreach component of research. Are there any particular ones that you'd like to highlight now as well, in addition to the ones you already mentioned?
So I think one of the challenges that I think is the time. Like we are still doing research mainly, and that's what most of the researchers are very interested in. So how to find time to actually do all these outreach and kind of also very impactful parts of our work. But I think also the benefits, I mean, like you said, that of course we get, I mean, it's important and you get sort of excited about doing research, but it is also nice when you can see that it has an impact on something, be that of a younger student getting excited about the field of research, or then some conservation law that now maybe mentions something we find important.
It must be very rewarding in a different way than, of course, the research itself. As a researcher myself, or researcher in training, you know, it is very rewarding to do the research, but I do love the science communication aspect.
That's why we're here. Exactly. But yeah, time is always a limiting factor. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about you, Kirsty? Do you have any particular challenges?
Well, coming from laboratory to going to commercial products is a huge challenge. Mm-hmm. So I have been lucky to have an opportunity to visit some startup companies and their facilities, and seeing how they have built up something, an innovation that has its roots in the laboratory, small scale, maybe flask or bottle, where something has been incubated and then brought to a product. And then when you are talking about tanks that like fill a whole industrial building, and that is still kind of semi-pilot scale and needs more upscaling in order to be cost efficient, it's huge. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of challenges there. And then what comes to more of this kind of communication of diets and processes, or those things I mentioned in food sciences, there's this misinformation. There are people who communicate actively in social media and delivering. People have strong opinions and they might want to present themselves as experts in something. And then if you're not really finding out about the actual facts, you might easily believe in someone who has many followers in social media. And that's why it's important to bring really expert information about those topics available.
That's where something like this two-way street of in the consortia that you've organized, Maria, really seems useful, where you're actively combating the misinformation that also policymakers probably come across every day when they're going about their life on social media as well.
Social media is a tricky place, isn't it? Mm. And I think also with people who think they're experts, it can even stem from them even reading something and misinterpreting it wrong, which is where I think it comes back to the basic research and the importance of not just publishing your paper, but also thinking about, even in something so kind of technical as a scientific paper, how this comes across. Because sometimes people read something and they're, oh, okay, this means this, when actually everyone in your field, they know, oh, you mean A, but if you read it on the face value, maybe people think you mean C or something. So I think this can come back to something as simple as this. And I have heard a lot of, misinformation is everywhere in all fields, but especially, for example, with vaccines. And I remember hearing one story of with the flu vaccine, someone was telling me that, oh yeah, I'm not sure about getting the flu vaccine this year because they're basing it off of the virus strain from 2 years ago. And I was thinking, because obviously I'm not an expert on this at all, but I was thinking, but isn't that just because of the pandemic that there haven't been a new virus strain? And the person I was talking to, oh yeah, maybe. And I thought, well, it's not false, you know, this information is not false, that it is that they're basing off something from before, but it's the reason why is the key thing, is what sometimes we forget to communicate, that we all know, that it's obvious to us scientists that, oh well, the reason is because that's the most recent one we have. But to other people, they'll be, oh, that means it must be dangerous, or it's not done properly. So I think having this two-way communication, as you know, when you realise why people may be thinking something, is, oh, okay, yeah, I can easily say what that is.
Yeah, I can bring another example from the food science side. It's actually genetically modified food. So that is a big issue in Europe because of consumers' resistance towards the idea. And that actually leads to the fact that other countries are going ahead. Mm-hmm. There are challenges related to this. If development is run by companies, maybe they have their own interests and what they develop is to support their own financial benefits. But if there is more research and inputs and more like supported development on that area, that could bring benefits that cannot be achieved in other ways. And this biodiversity issue that we already have addressed is something that we should take at least consider and try to benefit from all tools that are accessible to us.
Okay, so now linking back to High Life, which is actually what brought us all here today. So how does the work that you do link with High Life and its missions?
So as a High Life tenure track professor, of course, my work directly links with High Life of trying to conduct excellent science and then also work with questions that are trying to solve sort of global problems. And High Life has very number of sort of initiatives via which they try to support research across different stages of their career to carry out these kind of projects. So, for example, the bioresilience project that I work with as well, which is to try to understand how biological systems can be resilient to climate change. And I think there's another one working on sort of how northern climate helps agricultural research as well. And my personal aim in High Life has been to try to make research on biodiversity more visible mm-hmm. on High Life because it's still much of it is kind of focusing on more medical side of research, but then at the same time also to bring High Life more visible within the faculty that I work with. So kind of a again two-way directional sort of a change.
That sounds great. And what about you, Gersi? How is the work that you do link with High Life and its missions?
I would be happy to see more interaction between food technology, food chemistry and nutrition with other fields represented in High Life. So we would like to be more connected. There are lots of opportunities in the High Life community to network and collaborate and join forces. So
and I mean, even today is a good example because at the start we were thinking, how does your fields overlap? But I think even now, for me anyway, I can more clearly see how just from some short conversation, there is definitely a link between the food sciences and maybe not exactly in the lab, of course, what you're doing, but it, I think there is ways that, you know, High Life do in certain areas, I think, as you say, with molecular biology a lot more, but yeah, there's also ways that you can try and bridge these gaps more, and even people within High Life can really understand the different sides of it. And I think this is the aim of this podcast series as well, is to try and show people these different aspects of High Life and how we can kind of appreciate and also try and keep improving and spreading such research and knowledge.
Well, the global challenges that we have discussed, they are shared by all of us.
Yeah.
So that's what we are working.
Says in the name.
And I also work at the High Life education team and want to highlight kind of the importance of that on supporting early career researchers. So I think High Life has done a fantastic job in there providing support for younger students to actually go and learn new sort of methods in different labs and then also coming up with sort of innovative ideas of carrying out research.
I was happy to receive a High Life proof concept grant to develop further one of my innovations. So that way High Life is also supporting this side of the societal impact.
So one of the innovation events that High Life is also involved with is Why Science, one of the official side events of SLUSH. Are either of you involved with this?
Yes, we are there with our innovation related to these alternative proteins. They are mycoproteins. We are affiliated with the Viikki Food Design Factory and they have a germinator program. And within that, we are going to pitch our idea there in Why Science.
Okay. And have you done it before or is this the first year that you're part of Why Science?
I have attended Why Science, but not pitching.
Before,
interesting. I did give a presentation, but it was not to pitch an innovation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because I went to, and it was interesting to watch the pitches, and also, I don't know, for me, it's not something that, like, I ever would think about how to do it. So it's quite interesting watching them, and I feel like it probably brings a bit of a different skill set to your average research presentation. So, good luck.
Thank you very much.
And I guess related to this question, any advice for people interested in furthering their societal impacts of their research or going into innovation, for example?
Well, about the innovations, it's good to encourage researchers to report their ideas and innovations before they publish. That is something very important to keep in mind because after you have published it, it's more difficult to protect the IP. So one good thing that actually the Helsinki Innovation Services is doing a good job of reminding researchers to report their innovations and have that assessed and potentially even patented before publishing. So that's good to keep in mind if you find something interesting in the laboratory or elsewhere in your research.
And I would just maybe encourage people to get involved. There are also a lot of outreach events that are already taking place. So kind of joining those or then initiating, of course, ideas as well. And I think it's always more fun to do it in a group rather than try to initiate something just all alone, that with other people you can kind of come up with nice novel ideas of how to raise awareness of the topics you want.
And then you don't have to carry it all on your own shoulders.
Especially linking back to the time also helps if you have more people to help spread a message or set up an event and things. That's also what we try here at the Science Basement.
Yes, that looks very nice. Yes.
Okay, cool. Well, I think we've touched a lot of different aspects of the importance of the societal impact of science in this episode. And it's been great to hear from both of you in quite different but related, but pretty different areas of research, how your both experiences have linked to this societal impact and how it can be important in different areas. So do you have some sort of take-home message that you would like to give to our audience to think about in regards to the societal impact of science?
Well, I guess maybe as I come from the field where there's a lot of negative messages coming of biodiversity loss and what we as humans are doing badly, that it's good to remember also to be sort of a solution-based in the discussion. So try to come up with ideas of how do we improve things rather than just focus on the negative messages.
That's a nice message. And you, Kersi?
Maybe I would like to highlight once more the importance of basic research. Sometimes we forget that when we talk so much about innovations, but actually many innovations or even life-changing innovations are based on long-term decades of basic research, and we need to remember the value of that, and hopefully the society allocates resources for that also in future.
Second that.
Yes.
we can all second that.
I think so, yes.
Okay. So thank you both to Mario and Kersi for taking the time today to join us at the Science Basement podcast. It's been very, really interesting to learn about the societal impact of science, as I both said, from both your individual experiences and collective experiences. And I hope you both enjoyed the discussion today.
Thank you very much for inviting.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you. So to conclude the High Life mini-series, thank you firstly to all of our interviewees for sharing their expertise across many key research-related topics. And secondly, thank you to you, our listeners, for joining us. Remember, you can find all of the mini-series episodes by searching the Science Basement podcast on the podcasting platform of your choice. I've been Rhiannon Newman, and this was the Science Basement podcast collaboration with High Life. Bye!